Wow, that was wonderfully kind, Dr. Stinson, and we thank God for you. Mercy. By the way, I have a guest with me today. He's a Kurdish friend from Nashville who's come up to speak at my Ethics of Peace and War class. He was a translator for our troops in Iraq. His name is Amran Ari. Is he here, Amran? Are you around? There you are, brother. He was a translator for generals, and he said he had $1 million bounty on his head. I don't even think I've had a $50 bounty on my head, but that's amazing. But it's great to have you with us today. I was talking to a young pastor not long ago, and he talked about a mild rebuke that he got from a senior pastor, an older pastor. He was asked how his church start was going, and he said, "Well, we're finding good things happening. Prayers are being answered. A lot of excitement. God's moving here. There's a lot to do yet, but you know, we're having fun." And the pastor said, "Do you think that a pastor 100 years ago would have said he was having fun?" Whoa, you know. And so that's kind of a conversation. And I appreciate the fellow saying that, because there is a gravitas to the pastorate. You know, Paul said, "I never stopped warning you night and day with tears." There are fiery trials. There are fiery darts. We know all that. By the way, when I was in seminary, I remember, it seems to me that most of the chapel speakers were saying, "No, it's going to be horrible, but God's going to be there." And I thought, my goodness, I'm not sure I want to do this. But there is wear and tear. But I have to say to this pastor and to this young pastor, like, it really is kind of fun. It's fun to be a pastor. There's so many times and ways, just working with a text, and people are paying you to actually study the Bible and talk about it. Can you believe that? And you're in a room just going over text, and then a sermon just falls out before you, and yes. And then there's a concert. I was a pastor up at Evanston Baptist Church. We had a lot of Northwestern students, and they would have recitals, and you would go and sit, and they would be so proud you were there, and you'd take their picture and put it on the refrigerator, and you're listening to great music or what have you, and wow, that was fun. And then you go to a hospital and you visit, and you're there like 30 seconds, and they're so grateful, and they'll walk on coals for the rest of their lives just for you, because you just showed up and prayed over them. And it's like this, boy, in academia, you don't get highs this high, and you come early, and ladies will say, "Come to church early, we'll pray over you, pastor." And so you show up at 7:30, and they just widows putting their hands on, and you think, that never happened before I went into a classroom at Wheaton, that I recall. I mean, they wanted to lay hands on me when grades came out or something, so I want to just tell you, the pastorate is really fun. It's not all fun, it's not happy-clappy, but I'm just saying, it's great. And these guys in Macedonia, I submit to you, were having fun. So let's look at this. It's just a few verses here. It's chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians. I'll read it all, and then we'll just work through it. It says, "Now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in the service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will." Now, I don't know if this is a generic brother or something. I know Dr. Schreiner's working on HCSB update, so this is generic or otherwise, but the guys are in here, brothers. And let me just underscore the point that with regard to Macedonian giving, which Paul listed up, you guys need to be out there. It's like, well, the woman's taking care of the finances and just keeping everything pure. No, I'm just saying you need to be heroic in your leadership, in the stewardship of your family. And then he says, "We want you to know." And let me just say a simple thing. I had the job of being, and this doesn't even sound honorable, the public relations director for the executive committee of the SBC for a while. You know, PR. You have very few jobs where you put the word "just" before the title. Well, that's just PR. Well, that's my job. What do you mean, just PR? Well, I'm just a minister of the word. But I got into this job, and I started to think, what in the world are we doing, doing PR? And part of what inspired me was that the Bible celebrates great things that happen. It reports Pentecost. It reports this. And so as God was working through Southern Baptist, I was able to say, look at this. Look at this. Take heart. Isn't God great? So anyway, he's doing that here. And he says he wants them to know about the grace that God's given them. When I first read this, I thought, well, he's got it backwards. This is a typo. It's some kind of newfangled translation here. No, it's the grace that they showed, you know. No, it's the grace that God gave them. And I thought, well, of course that's right. Because we have no heart for Macedonian giving unless God's worked a work in our hearts. You know, it's his credit. I mean, you know, I remember when we were pastoring in Evanston, or I was pastoring, wasn't a co-pastor with my wife, understand that. But when I was pastoring in Evanston, there are all kinds of people who were pushing their kids along in the little jogging, you know, tricycles or whatever, and they were working crossword puzzles at Starbucks and, you know, just kind of enjoying their half-calf decaf spritz of this and that and whatever. And when they were passing our church, I never got the sense they were fighting against the impulse to go in and worship. It's like, honey, steel yourself. We're getting close, you know, to the door here. And, you know, safe pass. Now we can go have our coffee. They had no heart at all for singing the praises of God. They had no heart at all for joining in the fellowship of the saints and hearing the word preached. You know, it just wasn't in. It's as though when you get saved, you're like denim and you become velvet, or you're seersucker and you become canvas or something. You know, it's a change of fabric. And if these people had a heart to do what they're doing here, it's because God did a work of grace in their hearts. And it's kind of on the other side, too. If you're not of the fellowship of saints, it's kind of, this is hard on you. I was reading the other day that if cats eat chocolate, they're in big trouble. I think they blow up or something like that, you know? And it's like what we're saying here to someone who is not falling in love and in love with Christ, is it's almost like feeding chocolate to a cat. It's like, whoa, move on. We don't want to hear this. But those who are the redeemed know what it is to be transformed, where the things that you care about, you didn't used to care about. And the things that you obsessed over, now you don't obsess over so much. So he's giving glory to God here. By the way, it's the Macedonian churches. These people were very human. These weren't like, this isn't Mount Olympus. You remember read Philippians and Euodia and Syntyche and like, you know, come on guys, let this mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus. You know, cut the, you know, that sort of thing. So these were just very human people, but they rose to an heroic level. Now, out of their most severe trial, they gave out of trial. Some people talk as though they'll start opening up and giving and being generous when the pressure's off, when we get out of this particular crunch that we're in. And God, it's going to be special. It's coming soon. But I'm in a severe trial right now. They gave out of their trial. Their giving was tempered. It was tried in the fire. When I was dating my wife of, 44 years now? So we're hopeful it's going to work out. We were dating, and dating, by the way, was like you would call a girl and then you'd go out, and it's an old custom. But at any rate, forgive me that. And so we were on this outing, and we decided to play tennis. I was on the tennis team at Ouachita, and so yeah, we'll play tennis. Well, and she got a girlfriend, some other guy. And so we're out on these courts, and you know, tennis is like when you hit like this, you know, and like that, and but this is tennis like bink, you know, or like whoa, you know, it's over the fence, and we giggle, you know, gag-a-maggot. That wasn't tennis, that was pity-pat, you know, and a lot of people kind of think church is pity-pat, you know, it's like Nerf church, you know, you can play it in the living room with Hummel figures and, you know, it's all foam rubber and stuff. No, church is hardball. And Christianity's hardball. And these guys were tried in the fire, and they gave out of their severe trial. It wasn't a game to them. This was very earnest Christian stuff that they were doing. And then they had overflowing joy. Now, you've heard before, joy's not happiness. Happiness depends on happenstance, an inheritance, a good liver, you know, a diploma, whatever. And that's true. And I've tried to get a handle on joy. It's not just grinning all the time and something, but it strikes me that joy is the opposite of depression. I mean, if you've ever been depressed, you just want to eat worms and die. You know, you're just sort of flatlining. No, nothing really stirs you. You just want to sleep and you're just droned out. Joy comes when God's up to something and you think you're in on it. You know, it's like, I think something's cooking. That way, you can be in the Circus Maximus or you can be in the Colosseum and you're about to be eaten by lions, you know, and, you know, you're whatever, tooling around, and you figure, I'm about to be lunch, but there may be a kid on the back row of this thing who will notice me and ask his daddy, why is that man dying? And he might say something, well, it's something about Christus or Jesus, I don't know, and it'll plant a seed in that kid's mind, and he'll pursue it, and he'll come to the Lord, and you know God's up to something. Even in my death, something's cooking. I'm in on it. Joy. I count it all joy, and it can be very mean. The circumstances can be very mean. They gave out of extreme poverty. Notice that their giving was sacrificial. Again, people say, if we just get through this time, if we can pay off those loans, if we can do this and that, then, you know, then it'll come along great. One of my favorite guys in Southern Baptist life is named Jack Smith. Now, that sounds like an alias, but his name really is Jack Smith. Or he says it is, at any rate. It's his story. But Jack was a prosperous pastor in Alabama. Big kingdom come Southern Baptist church. Front page of the Alabama paper, columns, and all this. And as a good pastor, he decided to take his people on a mission trip. So he went to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where they had a great flood years ago. And he had been called up there, and I guess they had a partnership with Penn South Jersey, something like this. And anyway, he was up there, and the director of missions said, I want you to meet a couple of couples with Southern Baptist backgrounds, and they want to talk to you a little bit about their vision. So they went to a house in Johnstown, and as they sat there in the living room, they said, hey, would you preach a Southern Baptist sermon? We hadn't heard one in a long time. Now, I'm not sure what that would be. It could be just about anything. But at any rate, he said, you mean here with the DOM and two couples? And, well, okay. So he flipped through his Bible and found some old notes and said, all right, here you go. So he stood in the living room and preached a brief message, and they thanked him, and he turned the DOM and was talking, and they huddled on the couch, and they broke, and they said, we call you as our pastor. Well, he said, say what? You know, we call you as our pastor. We think you're the man, and that was your trial sermon, and you did okay. So he thought, oh, bless y'all, but I've got a job, and this and that. And so he's riding back, praying to the Lord, and Lord, please help those people. We'll hold the rope as someone goes down in darkness and let some poor fool from seminary answer the call and, you know, whatever. And God said, I don't think you heard, but you just got called. And he wrestled and he wrestled. He got back to Alabama, called his deacons together, and he said, listen, I hate to say this, but I'm going to have to leave you and go to Alabama. Go to Pennsylvania and pastor. And an old deacon stood up and said, Pastor, you're not going to leave us. We're going to send you. And they supported him in this work for a couple of years. He did a good work. He became the director, I think, of evangelism for Penn South Jersey, and then he went to work at NAM or HMB at that time, and relational evangelism. I think he was part of Strategic Focus Cities New York. God just got all over Jack, and he was just so sacrificial, but he was so full of joy. And that's the kind of thing going on with these crazy people here. That they just knew what it was to not say, well, let me run the tab on this before I say yes. And then it says, what did they do here? It's rich generosity. They didn't just give, they gave generously. I had a prof, I think I told you where I went to school, but maybe you'll never figure this out. He proudly proclaimed one day that he didn't tithe because he was teaching at a little Baptist school. If he taught at the state school across the way, then of course he'd have more money. So his teaching at a lower salary, and we wouldn't say good luck getting a job somewhere else, but at any rate, he was teaching at a lower salary, and that was his tithe, you know? It was though he's just looking for every way to cut a corner to kind of finagle a bit. I had a prof colleague at Wheaton who decided to build an addition on his house for a study, and he said, you know, I'm in the work of the Lord, so we'll just take what we give to the church for a while and pay for that. And I think, what kind of life is that? What is that tightness and cold calculation? Well, they didn't know it. They didn't know what that was about. They gave out of severe trial, and they gave out of poverty, and it welled up in generosity. He said, I testify, they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. Uh-oh, now it's gone really crazy. They're foolish now. They're not just admirable, they're nutty. To give beyond your ability, you're not supposed to do that, you know? Another guy. When I was with the Indiana Convention, we hired a guy away from Michigan named Carol Fowler, later hired him at Midwestern. Carol was a good old boy from North Arkansas. He was in the northern Arkansas hills where a lot of retirees from the Midwest come and get a home for retirement, and they were doing well, and he made the same big mistake. He went to northern Michigan to just plan a mission trip. Well, the hook set, he went up there, left a very comfortable income, and he went up there and he made money as a bivocational by coaching the high school baseball team and picking up dead bodies for the funeral home, going home and doing that sort of thing. And Carol, you know, glory's just all over Carol. He's so infectious. He led Indiana Baptist and started essentially four churches a week up there. We hired him down there, and you know, he's one of those guys that's going to make heaven if he doesn't run past it. Just delightful. And he was crazy. I mean, he was always crazy, even when he had an income, but he was really crazy going to northern Michigan. And I see that sort of thing, and I think, yes, yes. Now, incidentally, a lot of people think, yeah, that's it. That's the only way God really blesses you. You can do a church plant somewhere and go off to Timbuktu, and we'll make a big deal. I tell you, some of the greatest adventure today is going to a legacy church that's been declining, and you go in there and you bring new life to that thing. Boy, that's heroic, too. That's a joy, too. So don't use these examples to only think. Sometimes going into the church from Alabama, from Johnstown, is the heroic thing to do. But that's a calling too, and there is great joy in that. Now, it says entirely on their own. He makes a deal about that. It was natural to them. Stories told of an old preacher who would go down to the train station at noon every day and just sit there and eat a sandwich and watch the train come through town. It was a little town. People spoke. What's your pastor doing there, down there looking at the train? And, you know, some thought, maybe he is acting out, in a sense, his desire to leave. You know, if I could just be on a train, or I don't know what. They finally asked him, said, well, it's the only thing that comes through town I don't have to push, and I just like to watch it. And, you know, you figure Paul is kind of like that he's just, I keep promoting and pushing, and, you know, and then all of a sudden, boom, just on their own. They said, could we just give? Incidentally, I didn't say this for context, but there was great poverty and difficulty in the mother church in Jerusalem, and they were taking up collections, cooperative program, no, but at any rate, they were taking up collections for this, and Paul would be supporting these guys. And then they urgently pleaded with us. It gets crazier. Has that ever happened to you, pastors? You know, that they take the offering up, and then as you're leaving church, you know, they grab you by the pants leg and say, please, pastor, take more. Take more of my money. No, no, you must. What is this? Have people ever pleaded with you for the privilege of giving? Well, here's what happened, I think. When I was in grad school with my child bride, her dad was on the executive committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. He was president of the Arkansas Convention and later the executive director of the Missouri Convention, just a great man. When he died of leukemia, they named the state mission offering of Missouri after Reuben South. He's the Lottie Moon of Missouri, okay, or the Annie Armstrong. But at any rate, he would come to town and he would take us out to eat. And I was living on a little stipend that Vanderbilt gave me, and my wife was working at the Tennessee Convention, and we had a little Volkswagen that would more or less work, and he would take us out to eat steak downtown. We thought it was. It took us a while to recognize it. We didn't know what that was, but at any rate, we're eating steak. And at the end, I would almost always say, Reuben, let me get this. I'm thinking, oh, God, please, don't let him say yes. You know, we'll have to... you know, we'll have to like sell the car, you know, to do this. And I mean, for years and years, even after I was teaching at Vandy and at Wheaton and the like, and actually had a little bit of income, he would still say, no, you know, bless your heart, you know. Well, after a while, I got a little miffed. It's like, excuse me? I mean, do you think I'm utterly incapable of this? And I remember we were at Glorieta once, and we came back, and we stopped in Oklahoma City, and probably for the 30th time, I said, Reuben, let me get this. He said, yeah, thanks. Whoa, you know, walk up to the cash register there with me, you know. But I just felt, it just was joyful. It wasn't a pride thing, but it was just like, yes, yes. And I think Paul was doing a Reuben on these people. He says, I know your situation. Bless your hearts. Oh, you want to give? Oh, I'm going to put that in my journal, and I'm going to talk about it in a sermon. This is so touching, and we'll come back when you're stronger. And they say, excuse me? When the role of faithful churches is called, we're going to be there. Take the offering, please. And we ought to have that same spirit that when great things are being done, we don't have a pity party or victimhood or whatever. We just say, hey, we'll give it our shot because we want to stand up and be counted. And I love these people for their insistence and their pleading in the midst of their inability. And they did not do as we expected. Let me just say this. There are disappointments in the ministry, but there are a lot of surprises where you're just kind of trudging along and then somebody out of the blue will do something and say, whoa, did you see what? You know, I mean, my son and my wife actually just came off a mission trip to Haiti, and they were reminded of the old counsel we got when we used to go to Brazil in Arkansas. A fellow from Oklahoma named Wayne Bristow used to coach us, and he said, get your people on a mission trip overseas, and they'll discover that they're eagles rather than turkeys, and when they get home, it'll be hard to keep them out of the air. And we had some people who found out they were eagles, or people found out that they were eagles, and just like, whoa, did he do that? So the ministry is full of surprises. Paul got one here. They did not do as we expected. They gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. They were certainly insistent. They were surprising, but they were worshipful. This wasn't like, all right, it's time again, you know, the appeals come. Let's all pony up and do our bit. In fact, they didn't give themselves to the nagging of Paul. They gave themselves to the Lord. It was a worshipful act of giving. I used to be, and I wasn't much account in the military. They let me stick around for a number of years, but I was a threat to nobody. But I remember at one time I was an S4, a staff officer, logistical officer for an infantry battalion. And my job was to deliver food and fuel and ammunition and building things and so forth to troops. And one of my jobs was, and I was earlier a support platoon leader, which is kind of the gopher for the S4, and I would take these, they were called Mermite containers, or heated food, and I'd load them in my quarter ton or my Jeep, and we'd go crashing through Fort Hood or Fort McCoy or Fort someplace, Fort Campbell, and trying to find these guys, and they'd be stressed out and hungry and rained on and so forth. And when I drove up in my quarter ton with that hot food, it was just like, oh yeah, you know, the smiles there. But I never heard this. It's like, oh, Captain Coppinger, this is a cold world. These are uncaring people all over, and we're facing this enemy and so forth, but he saw us in our need, and he came out here with food for us. Who knows what he had to give up to come out here? They never did that. It was like, where have you been, you know? And the deal was, it wasn't my food, and it wasn't my choice. Uncle Sam said, hey, this is the food. They're going to need to get at least 1,700 calories a day, and you better be there at, you know, 1,300 hours or dark 30 or something with this stuff. I was just a conveyor of the stuff, and they knew exactly whose stuff it was. It was God's stuff. And so when they were passing it along according to God's will, they were doing it out of worship to the Lord. It wasn't like they were nagged into holiness. They just erupted in holiness because of the graciousness of God and the awareness of his provision in our lives. It was worshipful giving. And by the way, they gave themselves to us. Isn't it a joy to give to the apostolic causes? Man, we give to all kinds of stuff, I think. Sharon's got some, I think her dad died of leukemia. I think we've given to a leukemia organization. And we have these guys at the stoplights in Nashville selling the contributor for those streetwise or the homeless people. And I use Vanderbilt's library, and so I give a little bit to the Vandy Library Fund every, I mean, we go all the time giving to stuff here and there. But boy, when Lottie Moon comes along, sweet. Oh yeah, because that goes to people whose feet are beautiful because they're carrying the gospel. When Annie Armstrong comes along, oh yeah, they gave themselves to the apostolic causes. And by the way, the cooperative program, thank God for that, and we take joy in that. Oh man, these people are having fun. I mean, you know, they might not have said, hey, we're having fun. But, you know, I think if you press them, they say, I think there's something really joyful going on here. Look, I was preaching an Annie Armstrong promotion offering at a church in an Atlanta suburb one time. And anyway, there were about a couple hundred people there. It was so new that, like, I think it was like being in a fabric store. Your eyes stung from the, you know, from the dye in the carpet and drapes or what have you. And they had like a couple hundred people. And for someone who's been a church planter in Illinois, it's like, let me look at that again. How does that happen? But at any rate, I went to lunch with a pastor who's an old friend from college. And I said, look, how in the world did you start here? And he said, well, we knocked on a bunch of doors. And he said, one thing is we never asked, we said, well, why don't you go to church if you don't go to church? And he said, you know what the biggest answer was? You're always asking about money. As if they know. If they don't go to church, how do they know we're always asking about money? But still. And he said, so we don't bring that up. We don't bring that up. You know, we don't have these barriers and so forth and so on. And I thought, what in the world is that? I mean, didn't Paul preach the whole counsel of God? Isn't that part of the counsel of God? And immediately I thought of a friend from seminary. He pastored a church in Barstow, California. His name's Eddie Pate. He's been a prof at Liberty and Golden Gate and one of our missionaries. But Eddie was at Barstow, and he was like the man of the year in Barstow. He had a radio program, and they did all kinds of cool stuff. At their VBS, they had a snowball fight in the Mojave Desert. They get a big dump truck full of shaved ice, and the kids would make snowballs and throw it, and the newspaper would go crazy over it. He was just the greatest pastor. And one day, a Sudanese guy came through. And one thing happened after another, and Eddie found himself as one of our IMB missionaries in Khartoum, Sudan, where they had killed 2 million people in the south, recently killed people in Darfur, just a crazy kind of place. And so he was like Mr. Cool in California, and then all of a sudden he's dropped off the face of the earth. And we got this Christmas letter from his wife, Merla. She was just telling matter-of-fact things. They had little kids. And she said, yeah, I went to the marketplace the other day and bought some milk for the boys. And when we got home, we had to strain it through cloth a couple of times to get the donkey hairs out before I boiled it. And then she goes on to something else, like, sorry, what? Because they had been crazy and joyful crazy. And I wanted to go back to the guy in the suburbs of Atlanta and say, look, here's what you ought to say to those people. You're always asking for money. Just say, no, you don't understand. We're asking for your life. I mean, if this is a problem, you don't have a clue what we're asking. We're asking for you to surrender your whole life. And by the way, that is the way of life. And you smile because you think in your own life what life it's brought. Now, in just the moments that remain, I hope you'll forgive me just a little personal testimony about how we've just found some of this joy. Yeah, we were at Midwestern, but we got fired. I say we. My wife said, what do you mean we, fat boy? But, you know, we got crossed. And they've been really nice since, and they made an oil painting, and I taught two courses there, actually, and spoken in chapel. So it's been nice. But, wow, that's an acquired taste when you're in your 50s. And, you know, you're driving along to you don't know where some friends are catching you back in Nashville, and you're wrestling the Ryder truck, looking in the rearview mirror to see if she's still back there, you know, and, she would be. That wasn't, you know, she's a whither thou goest, long-suffering. As the old joke goes, never divorce, consider, but murder crossed her mind. And so we're pulling in there. And then all of a sudden, we're in kind of a fix. But then you don't say, okay, I'll just eat worms and die, or, you know, just write something really snotty and then just shoot somebody or something like that, or myself. But, you know, you just, every single day, you just get up and say, well, God's got something on my plate today. What'll I do today? I'll write a letter to my first grade teacher and thank her, you know, or I'll finally learn how to do this or that for be a hubby or something like that. But then the notice came, just pro forma, that we had pledged to the seminary development fund. And we kept our pledge. And it was fun. Because, you know, we weren't in charge of our lives. You keep your integrity and you do it joyfully. Because we believed in the seminary when I left, and the newspaper person, you know, said, what do you say? I said, hey, we're cheering from the sidelines. And we believe, and we're thanking God for Midwestern, have all through those years. And one of our own is over there now, and it's just great. But it's like, yeah, that's fun. Where are you going to get it? Hey, I don't know. Ask him. You know? So then we get called to be church planters in Chicago. And that was exciting. You know, there were about 12 cities that were contiguous up on the North Shore of Chicago, and there was no Southern Baptist work, and it was as many people as you've got in Wichita or Birmingham. It's a big chunk of Chicago with no Southern Baptist work. And so we jump in there, and one of my Wheaton colleagues said, all you need to get is one tither up on the North Shore, you know, and you got it. But we never got that tither. So we were scratching right along. It was exciting to be there. I was student ministry director, or BSM director, or BCM director at Northwestern. And when we finally grew to the awesome figure of 50 in church, we one time had like 50 in church and an offering of $38. Well, they're students. You know, Loyola, Northwestern, Trinity, Wheaton, you know, what have you, Kendall College, Moody. Praise God. So we discovered the world of bivocational ministry real quick. Sharon is a secretary to superintendent. Later, she was started with a principal. And then all of a sudden, things started coming around. Wheaton would say, hey, can you come over and teach a course here? To make a very long story short, we kind of pieced things together. And then I got to draw up a church constitution, bylaws, and so forth, and we put those in order. And through it all, we would tithe. Now, don't tell Dave Ramsey. No, is it Dave Ramsey who's in Franklin, my neighbor? Don't try this at home, boys and girls. But we ran up a lot of credit card debt because we had a girl in high school, and we felt called to be there, and we just weren't piecing it together. But we tithe what we got. So I would teach at Elmhurst or Trinity or Wheaton and doing adjunct things, and we were just not because, and people say the tithe, now see, now you've gone legalistic, and that's not a New Testament standard, and we're just supposed to live gloriously and happily and hilariously and all that. Yeah, fine. Look, to me it's a good rule of thumb, and I get hit every time I do this. So I wrote a column on it in Baptist Press. But, you know, some say, give till it hurts, you know, and others say, give till it feels good. Well, I don't want to go on the roller coaster of my feelings. I like to start with a tithe, and that's the tithe on the gross, and you just don't even think about it, and you just do it. And then, by the way, we wrote a tithe into our church budget. We're going to give 10% to the cooperative program. That was in our constitution, and 1% to the association. Say, yeah, fool, but where are you? They're trying to get your salary. Hey, come on. What are you asking me to be? Crimped and anxious and, oh, Lord, you know, let me... Look, I was raised in a place where they had stewardship promotions in the fall, and you'd get old couples up there to testify. We'd had these old pledge cards. Man, I never got over that. This old couple would get up there. He'd be a hardware store owner or something. He'd say, Martha and I got married in the Depression, and whenever we got two nickels to rub together, we'd give a penny to the Lord, and we never regretted it. And I just think, sweet, that's what I want to be like. I would fantasize about people like J.C. Penney who gave like 90% or something. Like, can you do that? And the thought of like being real anxious about it, what is that about, you know? Now, it wasn't like we were just sort of sitting in our hammock like, okay, Lord, you know, I'm going to throw myself off the temple and catch me or what have you. No, look, I mean, we worked hard. We really worked hard. I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. No, I'd get up at 5:30. I'd catch the 6 o'clock train out of Wilmette to the Northwestern Station downtown, get there around 6:30, catch the 6:45 to Wheaton, to College Avenue, walk a half mile, teach at 8 o'clock my intro class, wait around, teach symbolic logic at lunchtime or aesthetics, and then mid-afternoon, catch a train downtown, walk a mile, Randolph Street Station, catch the South Shore Line, go to Hegwisch down on the Indiana border, catch a cab to White Castle, have a White Castle, and it's awesome food, I'm just saying to my wife, and then catch another cab to teach for Trinity at Dalton from 7 to 10, get through at 10, have a student run me to the Harvey train stop, and I'm standing there waiting for a Metro train like at 10:15 on the south side of Chicago, ride that thing into town, get to Randolph, walk a mile to the Northwestern Station, get home at 12:30 in the morning, and turn around and do it again, and not get a whole lot of money. And when you're in your mid-50s, I mean, it's, you know, it's not quite as, you're not quite as chipper, you know? And then I would substitute teach. Don't, if you ever think you're going to substitute teach, that's not what it is. It's babysitting thugs, all right? You know? And you would get up there, they'd call at 6 in the morning, say, so-and-so's sick, and you come in, and they'd throw 10 folders in your lap and say, this is what you're doing this time and that. And I won't go into details, but we had guards in the halls who scouted out the gangs to keep them from representing and having their colors, and we had the Black Peace Stone Nation, the Gangs of Disciples, the Vice Lords, and the Latin Kings trying to represent. And we had people dropping F-bombs on you, and it was one thing after another. And at the end of the day, you collapse, and, you know, and they give you $90. And you start over again. And you know what? And again, forgive me my legalism here. I'm just saying, as a rule of thumb, do what you think God's taught you to do. But $9 would go to the Lord at the least. And then Lottie would come around and we'd give more. We were having the time of our lives. And then out of the blue, we get a call from Kairos Journal, and then Dr. Moeller or Dr. Aiken, different people call, and then we're doing a little of this and a little of that, and the next thing we know, we were solvent and so forth and so on. And I look at these guys and say, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah, sweet. Catch their eye, nod. Isn't it fun? Isn't it fun? Now, Jeff Foxworthy says, you may be a redneck if the last words of a close relative were, hey, y'all, watch this. I'm not doing, hey, y'all, watch this. You know, let's just watch God do a miracle here. You know, he'll just turn these stones into bread. But what I am saying, and it's what Paul is saying about these people, is, hey, y'all, watch God. Because he is so, and by the way, as one moody Bible student said when he was threatened with a knife, said, what are you threatening me with heaven? You know, I mean, when you're in God, it's all good, you know? A long time ago, I read a piece or heard a piece by John Osteen, who was the father of Joel Osteen, and he talked about people who weren't getting in on all the excitements of the charismatic movement and Pentecostal movement, and he said there's this poor guy who booked passage on a ship from Europe to America, and anyway, he's down in the hold, and he's got his beef jerky and his cheese, and he'll cut off a little bit, and, you know, they'd be down there in steerage or what have you. And then he'd come up on deck now and then, catch a sea breeze, and he spied the buffet, you know, in there. And all these people are just going up and down, you know, grabbing a little of this, and a little of this, and wowzer. Well, and then he'd go back down and eat his cheese and so forth. Well, he found out just as the ship was docking that his ticket included the buffet. And he'd been down there eating cheese and jerky and olives or something, and he could have had the crab legs or something like this. And he said, look, that's kind of like you Baptists. You're going to get to heaven. You know, you'll make it to America. But you know what? You're not doing the banquet. The banquet's yours. And come in and get our whole Osteen thing and, you know, God will give you rental car upgrades and all this sort of thing. But I like this story because I think it applies here. And you can be super scrupulous and protective and careful, and there is a good word for prudence, and there is a good word for being a responsible daddy. But what those kids need and what that wife needs is a daddy who is open-handed before the Lord with gladness. That shows, you know, I mentioned, I think, before in chapel once how Paul, when he got that Macedonian call, I know he didn't have a big family trailing around, but, you know, come into Macedonia and help us. And I'd like to, but have you got dental? You know, you go and you say yes. And so, look, I mean, if you're going to be real tight and guarded and super wise and anxious and nervous about your career and your income and your retirement and all that kind of stuff, yeah, you'll get to heaven, you know. We'll see you there. But I want to tell you what, you're missing the buffet of Macedonian fun. Dear God, help us to be so gladsome and so full of your transforming spirit. Help us to be so trusting of you that we can risk things for you, and we can do kind of wacky things, not out of calculation that somehow or other you'll turn our gift into a tithe and then multiply. I mean, not games, Lord, but just thank you for giving us a heart that's open and saved and mission-minded and just plain joyful, knowing that you're up to something, and by your grace we get to be in on it. Lord, I pray that as each of us in this gathering consider that very next decision to be worldly and scaredy in our thinking, that you would give us a touch of that Macedonian naturalness in the Spirit. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.